Now on Radio 4, it's the first in a new series of Chain Reaction, the tag team interview show where each week's interviewee becomes the next week's interviewer. Carrying on the chain from last series, this week it's the comedian Adam Buxton's turn to choose his interviewee as he talks to the co-creator and star of The League of Gentlemen, Reese Shearsmith.
Welcome to Chain Reaction. My name's Adam Buxton. Let me tell you about my guest this week, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very excited to be here interviewing Reese Shearsmith. Reese originates from Hull and is a talented young writer and performer. Having graduated from Bretton Hall Drama College with a BA, Hons, in theatre arts, he is a quarter of the award-winning comedy team, The League of Gentlemen, and has appeared in a variety of television shows and films. He's also written and performed in London's See Full Bio. I was a little rushed this afternoon, so that's all I was able to copy and paste from IMDb. To find out more, let's talk to Reese Shearsmith, ladies and gentlemen. What were you writing and performing in London's... He has also written and performed in London's...
I don't know.
It's like a quiz element we're introducing here.
Is there a right or wrong answer to it?
There is a correct answer.
Well, West End? Stage?
Incorrect.
What was it?
The long-running weekly satirical show News Review.
Oh, my God. Well, yes, if you want to go back that far.
I don't actually remember that.
Well, I don't think you were... born. It was, and that was a long... That's beyond... I can't quite remember it, but News Review is still around, and it's at the Canal Cafe, where we began as The League. It was a satirical sketch show. Still goes on. And you do things like, Gordon Brown taxing our food. songs like that. It's a little satirical, you know, that kind of thing. And it's better than that, but...
This is around 94, 95?
No, this is earlier. This is 90.
Really? Having got your BA Hons from Bretton.
Yes, Bretton Hall degree in drama, like having a degree in washing up, a theatre arts course.
What was the most technically challenging thing that you learned at Bretton Hall that you felt, this is an actual skill and part of a craft that I have now mastered?
Well, 8:45 every morning at Bretton Hall, there would be voice and movement. And I think it was the ability to widen the lower rib cage and open the diaphragm. Because one of the head, he's died now, but he was called John Hodgson, and he ran Bretton Hall, and he was and he said three main things of an actor: addition, articulation, and clarity of speech. It was diction, articulation, and clarity of speech. And he said it like that, in that way. And he taught us voice and movement. Your body is a violin. And he did this whole thing. He did it for every new set of drama people. He had a broken violin, and he had a brilliant new violin. He'd say, this is your body now. And this is your body in 3 years. What? This is your body in 3 years, translated. So, and then he died during it, so I didn't... My body's still the first violin, I think. But, yeah, I didn't really do very much at Bretton. The good thing about Bretton when we were there was that they left you to your own devices, really. And Steve and Mark were doing... Mark Gatiss and Steve Pemberton were in the year above me doing really funny things on their own, in their own time, and I kind of emulated them and wanted to be like them. And they laughed at me when I arrived, because my full name is Reeson, which is son of Reese. And there was a group picture of the new set of first years... And I was sat as if I was a little toff, and they found this picture and said, who's this? Reese and Shearsmith. Ew. And they thought I was a fun thing with that little Lord Fauntleroy type character.
You've got a middle name as well, though, right?
It's Wayne.
Reese and Wayne Shearsmith.
My name was going to be John Wayne.
Was it?
my dad liked John Wayne. It's as stupid as that. And then he changed it to Son of Rhys.
Your mum presumably argued him out of John Wayne.
I think so. I'm glad I don't like John Wayne.
He was, some people felt that he was a little bit of a right-wing creep.
It wasn't because of that. I just don't like the films.
Yeah.
I don't like Westerns, so I would not be saddled with it, quite literally, and I wouldn't want that. So I'm glad I'm called Rhys and Wayne.
Now, we were making TV programmes around the same time in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Your first series of The League of Gentlemen was on Radio 4 in 97.
Yes, this recorded very stage. Right. Quite literally, yeah.
This is the first time you've been back since recording those
it
radio
is.
Shows.
Not had anything to do with them since.
We were making programmes around the same time, like 99. Joe and I were doing, I think, the second series of our tremendous world-conquering Channel 4 show, The Adam and Joe Show.
Yeah, you were on. I very much remember you already being on as a thing on television when we were doing League. 1998, we filmed the first League of Gentlemen.
Yeah.
99, it was on.
Right. And I hadn't seen it when it went out on broadcast television.
Right.
So I was so busy waggling toys with coat hangers in them.
Yeah.
But we went to LA, me and Joe, to film some bits for our show. And on the plane, The League of Gentlemen was on the Comedy Channel. So I thought, oh, I've heard of this. Everyone's saying this is good. I'll see. I bet it's not that great. And I was struck by three things. Thing one. And these are all sincere things, by the way, so things are going to get a little uncomfortable for a while. I was struck by how funny it was. I laughed out loud at, we didn't burn him! Thing two, I was struck...
So I'm not interrupting any of this. I'm just letting you do it.
Okay. Or, yeah. You can interrupt if you disagree.
No, I'm not. So I agree.
Thing two, I was... I was struck by how good the acting was.
Ah, oh, very kind. Finally someone says it.
Yeah. That's been noted before,
yeah,
surely.
Well, not enough for
there
my
was
liking.
A total... I'm now reading from notes I've made because I would not be able to be this articulate off the cuff, but there was a total commitment to the characters that made them more than just grotesques and enabled them to interact with other quite naturalistic characters in a way that I hadn't seen before on a comedy show.
Right, yes.
And thing three was the attention to detail. But it had all been put together with so much care and craft that you'd normally associate with a far more expensive TV production or a feature film. And that was something I felt I hadn't seen in a comedy show before.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think we didn't think there's a way of doing comedy that's never been filmed before. We just wanted to film it. We did have a lot of our the appeal of what we wanted to do. Because it was started on stage, and then we'd done the radio here, quite literally here. And then we thought, well, now we've got this opportunity to do a film version of it on TV. How do we do it? Do we do it like we did the live show, which was in tuxedos? It's like three of a kind, with all three of us with white background and very minimal props. And I could never conceive that Steve would do Pauline not in front of a live audience. That was always such a thrilling thing for him to work the audience and have them there and respond to it. Some of the best things we ever did was always the live stuff, because we would mine and eke out and dig the knife in into the awful, excruciating moments and then let everyone off the hook in the room with a laugh. And that was always very powerful and worked really well. And I thought, how can we get that on? How do you do that? It's a very puzzling thing to try and achieve. And there's only three of us, and will it become boring if we have all these character makeups, and will we just not buy it? And there was a lot of things that just now seem like nothing watching it, but at the time there were big choices to make. But director was great. Steve Bendelack really got our references. And, you know, where other comedy groups would not have a wide shot of a car or a train going across a countryside because there's no joke in it, we kept it. We kept some air in it. And that's the thing that always goes instantly. It's like, you know, there's a great bit in the Monty Python, the Holy Grail commentaries, and it's fascinating to listen to their different opinions of what matters. You know, Gilliam's talking about the brilliant landscapes, and then Cleese comes on and goes, look at that, not laughing it. And it's just, that's the difference. And I think we were erring on trying to give it some space and give it that filmic quality where things breathe a bit more. Everything does it now. You know, it's, the drama in comedy is high these days. And I think we've always striven. Is it strove or striven?
Struve.
To have those elements. I don't think it's working unless there's a heightened moments of drama. I mean, we shoot ourselves in the foot because often it can nearly be funny and then we do something horrible and spoil it. But that's what we've always done, I think.
Well, we'll talk more about that later.
Yes, we will.
I first got to know you guys a little better. When I say you guys, I mean you and Steve Mark and Jeremy Dyson, when you kindly asked me to come and shoot some behind-the-scenes footage for your third series.
Ugh,
when you were doing
big
that.
Big mistake. Not because of you, but because of the whole element of bringing cameras into that process,
yeah.
You know.
Oh, so you're serious?
Yes. Yeah. We should never have filmed it. It was just...
Why? Why do you feel weird about it now?
It was never the same writing something with the camera on it. The camera would be turned off and then you could actually do it properly.
So this was... because half of it was stuff that you had shot yourselves. You were doing, like, video diaries.
Yes, it was all done, orchestrated, because Steve Pemberton wanted a video camera. And he said, if we say we're going to do a documentary about the video, we'll get free video cameras. That was what it was. And then we did, and he literally just today told me, here we are, 25 years later, whatever it is, that he sold it on eBay for £405. He said he can't even really use it. All the plugins are all wrong, and you can't. I said, well, who have you sold it to? He said, oh, just some fan that wants a bit of kit. Anyway, so
and the price you paid was non-stop intrusion throughout the creative
process.
Yeah, well,
it didn't help the process of writing because you felt like you were performing. Yeah. How can you act? I mean, I have a big thing about this, increasingly encroaching on the rehearsal process when you do plays and they want to film a bit of the rehearsal. And it's like, well, can we do it? Get it right first. It's like filming the magic trick to me. It didn't all have to be a mystery, but... let me get a little bit part way in before you start. Just give everyone wants so much of you and of it and of the process. And it's like, yeah, but people are interested. And I don't know if it's helpful. You know, it's funny.
But you as a fan are someone who watches these things, right? You listen to the DVD commentaries.
Yeah,
you're interested in the behind the scenes.
I do a little bit. Yeah. Increasingly, I'm not bothered, but it's hard to do a good commentary. We've always been very candid in ours, and that's probably what's appealing about them, because I just genuinely often try to speak the truth, you know, I don't try to couch it. And I'm a little bit less in real life as grumpy as the persona of me appears to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I am still quite angry and annoyed at a lot of things. So that comes across in the work, but it's only because I'm trying to do the best work,
yeah.
You know.
Well, that leads me on quite neatly to asking you to what degree you are similar to some of your characters. Because they're quite extreme characters. I would imagine that it's a question you get asked a lot, like whether you're in any way like your characters.
Well,
obviously, I don't think you're exactly the same. I don't think you're Papa Lazarou, but where do...
I am.
But that voice has to come from somewhere.
I am conscious of playing a lot of angry... I like disproportionate anger. I think it's very funny. It's lovely to be able to play pent-up rage and then outbursts of surprising, vengeful... kind of outbursts, and I don't know why that appeals to me. I have always played those parts in the league. Someone once very quickly analysed the league's formula, and it was just three people in a room, one of them goes mad, and it was all, and it kind of applies to all our scenarios, weirdly. But and I often was the one that going mad. But I don't know what it is. It's not particularly that I'm angry in real life. I'm not. I'm much more placid now than I think I was.
But yes, the genius is in finding these characters and then placing them in situations where they. Are funny because, you know, there's a lot of those characters might be quite tragic in certain real life situations.
Yeah.
But there's Dean Tavaluras in the third series.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was
magician.
Quite underused, actually. Yeah, we didn't do much with Dean. I think, weirdly, I was talking to Jeremy about it, Dyson, about the cruelty in that sketch where he's in a coffee shop and he's trying to do some tricks to these girls. We kind of wanted the kind of scary girls that you get on the top of the bus where you just think, oh, please don't stab me. And he dares to do a trick to them, and it's awful, and their friends come and they just spoil it for him and say, what's in your hand, mate? What's in your hand? Open your hand up. And they see that he's got a thumb tip in his hand. It's that thing that me and Jeremy both felt as amateur magicians when we were little, of someone just spoiling it for you, an uncle that won't go along with it, you know, cruel. And then we went to the nth degree and they burnt his hand with a cigarette, and it was really horrible. And I think it was too much, actually. And we were talking about how it was kind of just, we tipped over the edge in what we were trying to do. It wasn't quite us. It left a bad taste in the mouth. Where I think a lot of the things we do are, you know, I don't like it if people just jump to the conclusion that we're trying to do gross out, scary things. I think we always really have considered. And hopefully it's why it works and it's powerful, because we're careful with it. And that, I think, was too much.
And is that something you felt was too much after it had been filmed and when you were watching it all edited?
It's kind of no now.
Now,
only
right?
Now. Maybe I'm old and I'm like, oh, that's a shame. Cruelty. And I'm just kind of getting a bit more squeamish in my old age. But I do look back and think, oh, it's actually not. It's horrible. There's no joke to it. It's just cruelty.
So here's a very third-rate question. What is it then that you are doing when you...
are you doing then?
What the hell are you doing? What do you think you're doing? But when you add these very cruel moments, and I mean cruel, sometimes I mean cruel in the sense of one human being cruel to another deliberately, and then there are many moments that are just fate and life being cruel to a character. You know, it feels like you could often have quite a sweet, funny scenario that was still quite weird, but then it sometimes seems that you feel you have to add some other element which is really very sad or cruel or shocking.
Yeah.
Why do you think that happens?
I think that is partly to do with the dissatisfaction of how the scene feels if that element isn't there. Steve and I have often tried to write things that are lighter in tone, and it's missing something if it hasn't got someone being killed in it, or a high drama element where it's actually, you know, the stakes are high and there's a great peril. And it plays out like something that just makes you sit up watching television. All we really try and do is write things that if you started watching it, you couldn't not watch it till the end, and it would not take you where you expected. So, and it's born out of that. I feel it's always lacking something if it's not got... like, for instance, an exact example of this is the sardines episode of Inside Number 9, which was...
That was the first one.
The first episode, yeah, and it was a game of sardines, which is this funny parlour game where you hide, and then if you find the person, you stay with them, and slowly but surely everyone that's playing the game ends up trapped together, like sardines. And it was a funny idea, and we thought of it because we write in an office in Muswell Hill, and there's a big wardrobe in the office. And I just looked one day, and we thought, what about a game of sardines? And literally began from there. We wrote it with that idea, funny, every few minutes a new character coming in, till we got 12 people in a box, without the child abuse. And then we thought... Right.
This is the child abuse that appeared in the episode. You're not just sort of suggesting that there's always child abuse when anyone plays sardines.
In the episode, yeah. So then we thought, actually, what if there's some other thing, there's some other dread that's just rumbling under everything... And it suddenly came alive, and it felt like that's the thing, that's the missing element. And it would have been a perfectly acceptable, fine comedy without the thing, but it was so much better when it had that extra element and that reveal at the end that had the brilliant Tim Key doing this fantastic performance in it that elevated our writing to something else, you know. So it was a really great thing to think of that and add it in. But that's that thing that I'm talking about where it doesn't feel ready or finished until we've injected... A big element of drama, that's what I think we do. It's not just comedy.
I mean, you do... I sometimes get the feeling from you that you wish some of your stuff would cross over more than you think it has. And I would suggest to you that partly that might be to do with people getting cancer and child abuse stuff coming out. What about that?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you're right. On the one hand, I want my cake and be able to eat it, don't I? Because I wish more people would have seen Number 9s.
They did pretty well, I thought.
Oh, I don't know. Did they, Adam? I do. Yeah, they did all right. I mean, maybe it's telly. People have different ways of watching television these days, don't they? They don't watch it like Malcolm and Wise anymore. They mainline it.
It's the new way of watching TV, not watching it.
Yeah, apparently. But, you know, I do think those were, for us, quite... accessible.
Yeah.
I mean, the one we did that was mostly silent, which was a kind of an exercise again in could we do it? We began writing one that was we thought it's like a heist, and could we get like 10 minutes of them having to be quiet? And
there was no talking throughout the episode.
And then in the end, we wrote it, we managed to get 28 pages of stage direction, and we did the whole thing silent. Yeah. Not kind of a pastiche of silent comedy, because we couldn't speak because we were robbing the house. So there was a reason why we had to be quiet. And that was good and successful, but it was like Chuckle Brothers. Yeah, it was Steve and I just doing Lauren Hardy. I mean, it got a little bit horrible at the end, but generally there was a lot of stuff you could have shown 10-year-old.
I mean, this is a spoiler, but
you violently stabbed a dog halfway through with an umbrella.
With an umbrella, yeah.
The dog fell into a hat stand thing and you stabbed it.
I know, but it was funny. Yeah, it's true, we do. But then that's that thing, I want to kind of elevate it into not being just the nuts and bolts of comedy. Hopefully, I mean, we are always trying to not do the same thing.
And league-wise, sorry, but I'm contractually obliged to ask, is the door still open for more League of Gentlemen-style activity with the four of you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think we had a break 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and we thought we would do something. I think we would definitely want to do something. And we're not friends. I think we're meeting next month to talk about a thing that might eventually be our next thing.
Well, you've all become so ludicrously successful in your own right, it must be difficult to coordinate time-wise.
That's all it is, yeah. And it's just going, right, well, we're going to do a thing, but we have to say, you stop doing that, and we start doing this from this time onwards, yeah. So hopefully it will happen. I'm not sure that it will be Royston Vasey. I don't know if anyone could bear that it was that again. But it certainly would be a League of Gentlemen project, which is me and Mark and Steve and Jeremy under the umbrella of the league, which has never left us. We'll never leave, as we said.
We focused on your work with Steve and with the rest of the league throughout most of this chat. I mean, I was interested to know if you have an idea of a career that you would like to have if you didn't have your own. Like, what would your sort of ideal situation, fantasy situation be?
Well, I always regret not doing as much as I could have done with my art. I was always going to do something with drawing and caricatures. That or makeup and special effects. I did have a little foray into that. When I was young, I started a dialogue with Christopher Tucker, who did the makeup for The Elephant Man and lots of famous films at the time. And then out of the blue, he said, do you want to come and work with me? Apprenticeship. But I went because I thought, I can't not. It's an incredible opportunity. And I worked with him in this big mansion house in Pangbourne with the Elephant Man's head and Gregory Peck's head in my bedroom from the Boys from Brazil with a neck ripped out for about 2 months. And I thought, what am I doing? It was like Jonathan Harker in Castle Dracula. No kind of talking about what the arrangement was.
Yeah.
I was just getting up, slush moulding the head of Michael Crawford for all the West End productions of Phantom of the Opera, and thinking, this is insane. And I crept away in the middle of the night. It was terrifying. And I've never spoke to him since. He must think, what happened to him? But I just thought, I can't, this is just too weird, isn't it? Is there a fee? Am I being paid? I'm being slid my food under the door. Yeah, it was a curious time. And I've kind of managed to keep one foot in that and my drawings, because I draw a lot of the characters and sketches and stuff for the conceiving of the characters that I've drawn things. And they've ended up in script books and things.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the legacy of a lot of your work thus far. That was a little fart noise for my question rather than for your work thus far. Which I have nothing but genuine respect and enthusiasm for. A lot of your stuff's been very influential, I think, certainly in the comedy world. Like, it's influenced the way people go about shooting their shows and the way they look and the kind of performances. I mean, I feel that some of the voices that you do, the Pam Duve and Mr. Jelly and Papa Lazarou, have got so deep into my head, and I enjoy the sound of them so much that I feel them coming out sometimes when I'm doing silly voices in things that I've done before. Do you feel like you're noticing the influence in other people's work? And if so, how does that make you feel?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think we are a little Oxbow Lake caveat on the side of the Hulk of comedy. I don't see it at all. I mean, I'm obviously the wrong person to even talk to about it, because I don't see any. I think we did our thing and it kind of passed people by. I did this thing in December last year at the Royal Free, some sketches from the league, and we three were back on stage and Jeremy was in the audience. And there were some big people. There was Harry Hill and Rowan Atkinson was on, I presume they were going to be at the other end headlining. And they said, oh, no, you're last, you're on at the end. And I was like, I wanted to go to bed at 9:30. Thought, I'd be back home, I'd be the first half, and that would be it. But they kept us back like we were a thing. And it was genuinely surprising to me that, A, anyone knew it, and, B, that it was enough of a thing that they'd make it like, oh, it's an event. I find it odd, because I lived through it, and to me, it never reached heights of people knowing it. Obviously, people like you liked it, and I think a certain element of people loved it.
What do you mean? You mean people like me?
Because you've got good taste, Adam. That's why I'm sat here, as your choice. Anyway, yeah, so I don't know. I don't watch much comedy. I can't bear it. So that might be why I don't see the influence. I'd love the idea that people remember it and they take things from it.
Yeah.
Like Elder Statesman, but I'm not sure that it's quite revered like that.
I'm getting this image of you now. There's a scene in Psychoville where Mr. Jelly is standing at the back of a gym watching his rival, Mr. Jolly, is he?
Yeah, yeah.
Doing a Punch and Judy
not
show.
Real sausages! If you'd have up Mr. Jelly, you'd have got real sausages! Yes, I do remember
that. I just sort of imagine you with your comedy rivals shouting a version of "They're not real sausages." Have you ever watched an award show and shouted abuse at comedians you dislike when they receive an award?
Yes, I've done that. Yeah, I mean, I often think that there are award programs and something wins an award that you don't agree with, and it robs the bauble of its currency, you know. And you do think, well, that's. If I get one of them, I wouldn't want it now. Of course you do. And you would want always to be recognised. It's lovely when you do get nominated for things because you think someone's seen it. It's a leaky bucket, though. It's never enough.
Right, exactly.
And that's the problem. It drives you mad if you think there's a level of, and I'm all right now. You know, you mustn't think it. You just got to keep thinking, well, some people like it. If I can bear to keep doing it, I will. And that's my life. But no, every day genuinely sit and smile to myself that I'm doing what I do. You know, Mark and I play a game of how it would be if you were sent back in time to 1992 again and had to do it again, trying to make all the connections and just happy accidents that occurred for us to get on and get through the door. And it'd be impossible, I think, to do it. You know, it's such a lucky thing that we're allowed to do it. Because it is, like you said earlier, it's a niche, an odd, strong flavour what we do. But there's room for it, and I'm glad that we keep occupying it.
Now, as I say, your voices are very much deep within my soul now, for better or worse, and a lot of other people's too. And I'm always excited and interested to see what you do next. Thank you so much for coming along and talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Adam.
Reese Shearsmith, ladies and gentlemen.